Who is Ken Burns? Is he a trained historian? Does it matter if his documentaries are watched by millions of Americans with a thirst for history? Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, posed these and other questions concerning the well-known filmmaker by telephone to Gary Edgerton, professor of communication and film studies at Old Dominion University.
The late historian Stephen Ambrose once remarked that more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than from any other source. Over the past 20 years, Ken Burns has indeed become a phenomenon, his miniseries on the Civil War, baseball, and jazz drawing audiences to make most TV producers envious. Envious, too, are most professional historians of his sales of videos, DVDs, and books. There's even a line of Ken Burns jazz CDs. Why does the American public love Ken Burns? And is Ken Burns' history good history? Well, joining us today to examine Ken Burns' distinct vision of history is Dr. Gary Edgerton, professor of communication and film studies at Old Dominion University. Welcome, Dr. Edgerton.
Glad to be here, Eileen.
Let's start with the simplest question. Who is Ken Burns? Is he a trained historian, a professional historian?
Well, you know, when I think of Ken Burns, I really think of, from a professional point of view, I really think of him in three ways. And first and foremost, he's a filmmaker and a storyteller. And when I look at his films, I think that that's most important because the decisions he makes ultimately when he comes down to things, whether in terms of priorities, narrative seems to me to be always his largest priority. And in that way, he is, you know, a filmmaker like any other. At the same time, he's, you know, the way I would describe him more is a popular historian. You know, your question in terms of whether he's a trained historian, he isn't. You know, he had a few history classes as an undergraduate at Hampshire College, but in lots of ways, he is, you know, a self-taught historian. He's a very smart and articulate man, and he has, I think, of all the filmmakers I've observed and analyzed, he certainly has more similarities to a scholar than any other. You know, he certainly thoroughly researches his subjects along with his team. He's still very much involved in that, you know, even though he's been at this for 25, 30 years and he has a whole group of people working with him. You know, he's involved in the writing of grant proposals and the analysis that's part of that. And he collaborates and debates with scholarly advisors, and there are more advisors on his bigger miniseries, but he's very much connected with and involved with the academic world. I think there's a lot of heat that is communicated about the conflicts he has from time to time with scholars, but you know, by and large, he has much more of a cooperative relationship with more scholars if you look at his career as a whole. Third, though, he, you know, and I think this ties into your introduction, he's a television executive and a producer, and he runs a small independent production company, and part of that, too, is, you know, he's in business, and he's in business to, you know, keep his employees in work and him as well, and in that way, you have all the ancillary products that you talked about that are part of his television histories, and it also brings up the important issue, which I think you suggested, the whole idea of commodification of history.
You mentioned that that Ken Burns has been doing television programs for about 25 years, but it was really his Civil War series in 1990 that put him on the map. And why was that series on the Civil War such a television landmark?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I think there's a lot of reasons, but prior to that, just if I could, you know, just preface this with, he really, prior to the Civil War, if you're thinking in terms of filmic circles and also documentary circles, he was very well known. And, you know, I've interviewed him a number of different times, and one of the things he explained to me prior to doing the Civil War, that he really had thought that he had accomplished all he would be able to accomplish in his, you know, in his profession. I mean, he won loads of awards for the six films that came before the Civil War. And then he said the Civil War came and it was almost like he was born again. You know, that what I think happened is not only was his wildest dream realized, but also he changed the parameters and the possibilities for documentary filmmakers in general and historical documentarists in particular. The Civil War, a lot of reasons, I think, why it was popular. You know, there are aesthetic reasons, the technical and dramatic quality of the miniseries. It is 11 hours long, and the narrative, you know, hangs together very tightly. And it's difficult to do when you're talking a 90-minute to 120-minute film. When you're talking about 11 hours, it's quite an accomplishment. There are all kinds of institutional reasons when I think about it, and you know, this may seem a little bit more arcane, you know, more for film studies communication people who study the industry, but the whole idea that it was scheduled, you know, from Sunday through Thursday was actually a gamble that most of the miniseries is that they would have, and they still have now on public television and in other cable channels. They usually do it on a weekly basis. But what this allowed was a momentum to be built up, and the audience not only maintained but increased during the week. Huge marketing blitz, the amount of marketing that was tied to the Civil War, you know, was unlike anything ever tied to a documentary before. That, you know, 200 copies of the miniseries went out to TV critics beforehand, so it created word of mouth. You know, if the series wasn't good, then critics wouldn't be giving it good reviews, but in a certain sense, audiences were primed because all of these articles were coming out in newspapers. And the ancillary products that you talked about, too, the book, it's, you know, the companion book, sold 800,000 copies within the first year and over a million, and the videotape series afterwards was a million. Ultimately, though, I think the most important reasons, though, are conceptual, historiographic, that what he was doing was, in a sense, reinterpreting the Civil War for a new generation. As a film historian, I look back and see, you know, how seminal some films about the Civil War have been, from The Birth of a Nation in 1915, which really defined it for that particular generation, in a much more conservative and racist way than we certainly would look at it from our perspective now in 2003. Gone with the Wind in 1939, and then what you have with the Civil War in 1990 is taking this seminal event in American history and reframing it through the eyes of a baby boomer filmmaker. And in that way, the bottom-up approach, which had been well developed in the historical discipline for a generation, was now incorporated into the storytelling that, two common soldiers, Elijah Hunt Rhodes, a Yankee from Rhode Island, and Sam Watkins, a Confederate from Tennessee, you know, we were able to follow them as well as to follow all the, you know, the powerful and famous names that we usually associate with the Civil War. There were a lot of other common people, too, that in a sense brought the past into the present for such a huge audience. And, you know, scholars try and stay away from, or at least be careful with, presentism as much as possible. But I think one of the intents of most documentary filmmakers who do history is they really strive for that. They look for those elements that are most relevant in the present, in the past events that they are putting on film, and if they're successful in doing that, then they find it, you know, the audiences find it compelling. The Civil War still is the most watched series in public television history. 38.9 million people watched it, that week in September 1990. 70 million Americans now have watched the Civil War. And when you look in terms of, you know, how many people watched documentaries prior to that, you know, this is just unheard of, that what he really did was redefine not only the place of documentaries on American television, but also redefine what is possible with a documentary.
Ken Burns also seemed to redefine the documentary style in terms of filmmaking. How would you describe the Ken Burns style?
Well, in a word, it's a collage. That all of the techniques that he uses have been used before, and in fact, they're pretty traditional, that most of them harken back to the 1940s and 1950s. What his genius is as a filmmaker is he put them together in a seamless way and, you know, where they might have been used separately in the past. You know, he put four or five different particular techniques together, and there's a certain chemistry to them, to the point where when one thinks about people today, I think have a hard time remembering when Ken Burns's films came out and Huey Long, you know, made movie theaters that actually had commercial distribution as well as television in 1986, all of the reviews talked about how fresh and original this style was. But it's become so successful, in fact, he's usually criticized now for repetition, you know, but the point is, it isn't so much his repetition as much as his style has become normative for an entire generation of filmmakers. He's known first and foremost, of course, for what's called the refotographing technique. And, you know, it's still in motion, where he looks at photographs and, you know, has a lot of panning and zooming and movement within the photographs. The way this works is if you'll, you know, the next time you may watch one of his films, the live footage he has is always, is almost shot like a still photograph. So the live footage is, you know, very formal and academic, and there's not a lot of movement in there. And then when he moves to the photographs, all of a sudden that's where all the action occurs. But what it does is jumpstart those photographs and really makes them come alive on screen. The skeleton of his technique is an off-screen narration, you know, which is usually telling the particular story and giving the, you know, the details of whatever the particular subject is. Tied into that is what he refers to as his chorus of voices, which is readings from personal papers, diaries, and letters. And, you know, usually he has, you know, accomplished performers who are doing that. And when you think about it, you know, people think in terms of recreations and you know, being a fudge for nonfiction filmmakers, something that they shouldn't do. But most of the time, they think in terms of it as visual recreations, of having someone, you know, dressed up in a historical garment and playing a particular character. But these chorus of voices off-screen have always been recreations. But what it's trying to do is to take these words from, in the case of the Civil War, that are, you know, 150 years old, and trying to make them passionate and energetic and relevant to a, you know, a contemporary viewer. There are also experts, witnesses, who are interviewed on screen, and in fact, a lot of people from the Organization of American Historians or American Historical Association, you know, find their way into films this way. And also, their work gets known by a wider audience because of the audiences that watch some of these films on public television. Probably the coup de grace is the musical accompaniment in the background, which is always important to give an emotional context. And what he uses is period composition and folk music, and, you know, from the time to again, another artifact to bring the time alive. You know, one little anecdote is when he started making films with Brooklyn Bridge back in the late 1970s, he had no choice in terms of the kinds of musical accompaniment he had. That, you know, his budget, interestingly, the Brooklyn Bridge, which is an hour long, took 5 years to make, almost as long as the Civil War. And the reason is just the difficulty that independent filmmakers have with money and raising money. And what he did for the soundtrack was literally go to flea markets and, you know, find old recordings to get, you know, and period music was the easy thing for him to get. On the other hand, which has been a characteristic of his entire career, is taking that limitation and turning it into, you know, one of the strengths of his style. And now, even though he can afford probably any kind of soundtrack that he wants to use, the whole idea of using, you know, period music as a background has become such a part of this signature Ken Burns style. You know, the refotographing, the narration, the chorus of voices, the, you know, the witnesses on screen, and also the musical soundtrack.
We only have a few moments left, but historians often complain that too many people today learn their history from going to the movies. Well, I guess the question naturally follows, is watching a Ken Burns series any better than going to a film? I mean, is it a good thing that, as Ambrose said, more Americans get their history from Ken Burns than from any other source?
Yeah. I don't know whether so much I would think of it as better or worse, you know, as much as complimentary. You know, certainly when you deal with Ken Burns, that there and all of the other historic, because we're really talking about a generation of historical filmmakers, you know, that what is happening certainly is a shift in emphasis, and it's happening within the culture. You know, the visual media you know, are rising, so in that way people have an interest. I think the mistake some people make is to think of it in terms of either or, and also to think of it in terms that more people get their history from Ken Burns, but what that might imply is they don't get their history from any other place. And I don't think that that's true. That I think it's a good thing, because I think it brings, you know, where history might have been more on the margins 20 years ago in terms of the popular consciousness. You know, more Americans than ever, if you're thinking the last 50 years, are passionately interested in history. You know, some people just stay on the level of very popular history, and there are certainly more popular expressions of it than Ken Burns, and there are more popular expressions of it on television than Ken Burns, and there are different levels. And I think these popular expressions bring people to, you know, to other ones as well. That one thing that happened with the Civil War series is not only did Ken Burns become very popular, but there was an explosion in, you know, in books about the Civil War in general. And when you look at, you know, with your introduction, you talked about all the ancillary products with Ken Burns. One of the things that does happen, too, is when you look at all the 16 topics he's done so far, in the same way that a certain light is shed on these topics, and those topics become an agenda item. It's something that people become interested in. So I see television histories as a good thing, because it introduces people to the topics, and what it leads some of these viewers to do is to be aware of things they wouldn't before, and to investigate deeper into these historical subjects, which is a very good thing for them to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Edgerton.
Now, I'm pleased to be with you, Eileen.
We have been talking with Dr. Gary Edgerton, Professor of Communication and Film Studies at Old Dominion University.
Baby, can you ride with Daddy tonight? Baby, can you ride with Daddy tonight? I want you to ride with Daddy, honey.